Hello everybody, welcome back to the show. My guest today is Paul Bloom. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, professor emeritus of psychology at Yale University, and an author. The human mind is a mystery. If it wasn't for the fact that we experience it, the universe would give us absolutely no indication that consciousness even existed. After an entire career studying psychology, Professor Bloom has some answers to the psychology questions we've all asked ourselves. Expect to learn whether you can actually remember everything that you've ever experienced, whether we know why consciousness evolved at all, why we should remember Sigmund Freud, why babies are way smarter than you think, whether attachment theory is rubbish, if psychology can tell us how to live a good life, and much more. Don't forget that if you are listening, you should have also got a copy of the Modern Wisdom Reading List. It is 100 of the most interesting and impactful books that I've ever read. Fiction and non-fiction, real-life stories, and there's links to go and buy them and descriptions about why I like them. And it's completely free. And you can get your copy right now by going to chriswillx.com/books. That's chriswillx.com/books. In other news, this episode is brought to you by Whoop. Whoop is a personalized digital fitness and health coach that monitors your body's physiology 24/7 via a non-invasive wearable and provides you with feedback on your lifestyle, training, sleep, and recovery via an accompanying app. Whoop is much more than just a fitness tracker. It is a coach that can help you identify areas for improvement in your life, reinforcing positive behaviors and helping you to alleviate habits that have a negative impact on your overall health and well-being. The sleep tracking is really, really great. It is such an important red pill to take that the time that you spend in bed is not the time that you spend asleep. And learning how long you need to be in bed in order to get an appreciable amount of sleep and how that impacts your performance the next day and how the habits and the foods that you're eating and the supplements that you're taking change your HRV and your resting heart rate and your breath rate. It is very, very comprehensive, but made incredibly simple by the app. Also, you can join for free, pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap, plus you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. In other news, this episode is brought to you by MyProtein. You probably need some more protein in your life. Pretty much everybody does. No one is eating enough of it. And the best protein that I have ever found is MyProtein's Clear Whey. It's light and fruity. It's so easy to drink that you can have it during a workout, but it has more protein in than a normal protein shake. Also, if you've been suffering with digestive discomfort or bloating from most other proteins, this is a really good solution. On top of that, their accessories, their protein foods, like their layered protein bars and protein flapjacks, everything is fantastic. Gone are the days where protein food supplements taste terrible. They've even got different types of beef jerky and yoga mats, clothing, whatever it is that you need. MyProtein's got it. They do international shipping, and you can get a 37% or greater discount site-wide and worldwide if you go to bit.ly/modernwisdom and use the code modernwisdom at checkout. That's bit.ly/modernwisdom and modernwisdom at checkout. And in final news, this episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. One scoop of Athletic Greens contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, including a multivitamin, multimineral, pre and probiotic, green superfood blend, and more that all work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet. It's NSF certified for sports in the US, meaning that even Olympic athletes can use it, and it tastes really good. Most greens drinks are like the bottom filtering of a septic tank, but Athletic Greens is genuinely really nice. It's lifestyle friendly, whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar. But most importantly, it just works. It makes my digestion feel better, it makes my energy feel better, and I can really tell when I haven't taken it. So if you're looking to make an upgrade to your nutrition and really invest in your health, this is a great place to start. Head to athleticgreens.com/modernwisdom for a 60-day money-back guarantee, a year's free supply of vitamin D, 5 free travel packs, and more. That's athleticgreens.com/modernwisdom. But now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Paul Bloom.
Yeah. What do we actually know about human consciousness? Do we know why it evolved or what its function is?
No. We don't know. We don't know why we're conscious as opposed to zombies that are fully functional. We don't know how the brain gives rise to consciousness. We know it is the brain. I mean, the best science tells us that a consciousness emerges from our very physical brain. But one of the great puzzles in psychology is how does a 3-pound piece of meat, bloody meat, gives rise to, you know, love and hate and the feeling of a first kiss and slamming your hand in a car door and being on a podcast. There's a lot we do know about consciousness. We know how it works in attention and perception. We have theories of differences in conscious experience, but the big questions at this point elude us.
I've heard that one potential explanation for the reason that consciousness comes about is that it's kind of a byproduct of us being able to have quite a complex theory of mind of other people, that when you have a large social group and I need to be able to predict what Paul thinks about me thinking about that person and what they think about him thinking about me, that you end up having a lot of layers of abstraction, and that basically consciousness is potentially kind of like a side effect, like how a light bulb gives off light, but it also gives off heat, that all of the fancy mental imagery that we get is just kind of dressing on the side of that.
I think it's possible. One issue here is there's two senses of consciousness, at least, but two things people talk about. One is sort of what scientists call access consciousness, which is the idea of information being available to us. You can mull it over, you can analyze that. And I think that's really necessary for high-level reasoning, for language use, for making sense of what other people are doing. So I'm not right now directly conscious of my blood pressure and heart rate. It's just unconsciousness, fine. But I'm conscious that I'm talking to you and I know you, we met before. And the fact that I'm conscious of it means I could talk about it, I could reason about it. And we have good theories of that. The more mysterious thing is what's called phenomenological consciousness, the feel. And some philosophers think you could have one without the other. Like we could be fully reasoning, and maybe AIs are like this, or will be like this, where they're able to reason and make arguments and have and understand other people, but the feel of it, the feel of being a person right now, the feel as you're sitting there, of the seat against your behind, the feeling of headphones in your ears, where does that come from? And that's kind of a mystery. And it may be epiphenomenal, something else, but then you have to explain, why is it epiphenomenal, that?
What do you mean? What's the word epiphenomenal mean?
It means that you have a certain something with a certain function, and then something else comes as an accident from it.
And what would be another epiphenomenon that humans have?
The say one example is there's all sorts of things about blood which are really essential for what blood does. But the fact that it's the color red when brought into the light is epiphenomenal. It didn't have to be red. It could be green. Could be brown. Doesn't matter. There's no point to it.
I learned the other day that there is a particular genetic mutation in some Asian people which causes them to have both, I think it's low blood pressure and extra dry earwax. And you think,
yes.
So give me the adaptive reason.
So that's another example. Some people, when they stare into the sun, will sneeze. Now,
what?
You know.
Why?
That's a good question. I don't know. There's a story behind it, but the story isn't our ancestors who did this reproduce more than those who didn't. I mean, I'm as much of a fan of evolutionary explanations as anybody, and my book's full of them, and you know, reasonable stories for perception and sexuality and reasoning. But when it comes to the feel of consciousness, some people say it's as much of an accident as the sneezing. I don't know. One thing which is kind of cool, which is something I've been getting interested in recently, is how our consciousness differs. And so there's people, as you know, with synesthesia, whose senses blip over from one to another. So there's a story of this Russian guy who when he looks at words, tastes them. And this is so much he can't read the newspaper while he's eating breakfast because it spoils his meal, you know. Then there's other people on the other extreme who have, I think it's called aphantasia, no visual imagery. There's weird kid. There's a guy on Twitter who said, I don't know if I have like 30, 40, something like that, way into his adulthood, says, I always thought when people said they have images in their heads, they were just, it was just a metaphor. But, you know, he had none. You close your eyes, nothing. Can't see anything. Can't draw up anything. Some people have voices in their heads. I'm not talking about schizophrenics. I'm talking about sort of a narrator, like in these, you know, these comedies or these movies where there's a narrator and a little narrator. Some people don't. Maybe we experience pain differently. Maybe we see colors differently. That's kind of cool.
The fact that we're able to hear a voice in our heads when we think it, and you think about a interaction that you had with someone, an embarrassing one or an enjoyable one or a loving one or whatever, and that you can hear a sound, but you can't hear the sound. There's no sound being played anywhere.
No.
That, and I think that this may be because my... I've heard that certain people are more image-oriented.
Yeah.
Other people seem to be more, whatever, auditory-oriented. I wonder whether there's some people that are kind of more somatic, like they feel. I wonder. I don't know. But for me, I'm definitely lean more heavily on hearing the words, hearing them spoken. Yeah. Fuck me, they're loud. They're really loud sometimes. And I think, how can I hear anything? And they compete. You could be listening to something. Actual sounds of actual words can be coming into your ears and being played to your brain, and yet you can be hearing your inner voice talk louder than real words.
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, there's research with mental imagery that finds that when some people in laboratory experiments create an image, so they ask you to sort of close your eyes and think of the inside of your house or your apartment. You know, count the windows, walk around and count how many windows there are. You could do that, navigate around and everything. Now, while people do this, their visual cortex is activated. The same system that actually sees is activated, suggesting that in some sense you're seeing it. Now, I don't know if these studies have been done with sound, but it wouldn't surprise me if the auditory cortex was activated. You know, I can sometimes call to mind, not just voices, but music, chords, for instance, that, you know, and I hear them as if I was hearing them.
You talk in your new book about the system of human memory, and I think that you've just nudged there on one of the ways in which it could be a little bit more fallible. Just how useless of a system is the human memory construct?
The human memory construct is extraordinarily useful. Just try getting amnesia and seeing how well it works for you. You know, these disorders where you lose your memories of the past, or these cases, like these famous cases where people can't form new memories, is in the excellent movie Memento, Christopher Nolan's film, where this guy can't form new memories. But it's not what we think it is. And sometimes when people tell me, you know, oh, psychology is just common sense. Tell me something I didn't know. Well, I got a list. And memory is one thing on the list, where a lot of people think what happens in memory, it's like you hold up your iPhone, and it's just, you know, recording the world. And then it also stays in this hard drive. And then later on, through hypnosis or a kind therapist, it could all come out. It's just there. And this is total nonsense. Most of what we experience is lost forever. You don't attend to it, it just doesn't get in. And then when you recover a memory, when you say, what happened to you? We talked a while ago. How did that conversation go? Where were you? Where was I? What was said? In some part, you know, we go back and there's a storage system there. But in some part, it's a reconstruction, you know. If you said to me, boy, that was quite a storm the day we talked. And then a week later, you ask me to remember, tell you about the day we talked. I might say, yeah, it was a storm, wasn't there? Because what you tell me creates the story, and leading questions can create false memories. You know, there's a study after 9/11, a couple of my colleagues came and they asked people, where were you when the planes hit? And these guys, a bit older colleagues, yeah. And people gave their stories, and then they went back and asked them like 5 years later, 10 years later. And the stories are entirely different. We just, our memories are deeply unreliable.
I'd heard a bro science rumor that nothing is forgotten. Everything is kept. And it is a case of us unlocking that.
Are you totally wrong?
You're
totally
definitively wrong. Saying that that's horseshit.
Horseshit.
How do you know it's horseshit?
It's horseshit in a couple of ways. One way is that some things that you experience, that you're sort of right in front of your eyes, you don't attend to them. Most of the world you don't attend to. You attend to like a percentage of the world. If you don't attend to it, it's not gone 6 months later. It's gone 5 seconds later.
What do you mean when you say attend to it?
So there's a wonderful experiment done. It's a classic experiment. People probably have heard of it before. Where you get people to watch a film and you get them, there's going to be people wearing different color t-shirts and tossing basketballs back and forth. And you ask them, at the end of the film, how many basketballs are tossed? And people, how many times there is a toss? And you'll say, oh, was it 18? Was it 17? That's not what the study's about. The trick is that in the film, somebody with a gorilla suit walks into the middle, pounds his chest, and walks out. And people don't notice even the front of their faces. And because their attention is drawn one way, the rest of the world is invisible to them. In fact, it came to a book called Invisible Gorilla, summarized by Dan Simons and Chris Chabri. And you're not going to remember the gorilla because you didn't attend to it. If you don't focus on something, it's gone. So that's one way it's horseshit. The second way is there's just no evidence for this sort of perfect recording. People, the reason why this, I guess, bro science thing has come up is you kind of feel that way. You feel, oh my God, a photographic memory. I remember exactly what it is. I can recreate it exactly. And people have memories that are confident and powerful and genuine and false. So, and I think we mistake the confidence for the reality. And this, by the way, so much of my book is sort of theoretical stuff, which I think is really cool, but not of much practical value. This has practical value because of eyewitness testimony. Somebody sits on a witness stand and says, that was the man who attacked me. And they point to somebody. And juries hear this and says, well, wow, that's sincere. That can't be wrong. The person's so confident. People are confident. Then you do a DNA test or you check back and the person didn't do it. And so now we have a better understanding of the weakness of eyewitness testimony. We're particularly bad when it comes to other races, recognizing and remembering their faces. And you know, so there's a practical value in knowing this.
I remember learning before I even started this show about a study that was done on babies when they were young, being shown different images of sheep and what the babies would do because they hadn't learned to condense together all sheep faces into just a sheep, that they were paying more attention because they could see that's one sheep, that's another sheep, but a different sheep, that's a third sheep, different to the first two. Whereas, and I think it was maybe around age either 6 months to a year or so that they lose that ability, presumably the same way that I always heard that we could wiggle our ears, but because the muscles don't get used, they atrophy away.
I heard, cool.
I might be just spouting total bro science at you today. I heard that is a similar system that's online as to the reason as to why we struggle more so with different races to be able to pick their faces apart. Do you think that sounds accurate?
It might be. You can use, in some ways, babies are the perfect, you know, amateurs. They don't have experience in anything. Well, we are an amateur in some way versus other ways. So the story for adults, I'll tell you the story for adults. You can tell me if it connects to the baby story. The story for adults is it's the race effect has nothing to do with your own race. It's just who you have the most experience with. So if I see 10,000 white faces and I regularly have to distinguish them more or less, maybe for like 100 of them, I get very attuned to small differences. Just like if you're really into, classic rock. You'll distinguish this Pink Floyd song from that Pink Floyd song, this Zeppelin song, that Zeppelin song. But if you don't have much experience or interest in something, it all blurs together. Oh, that's more classical, you know? Or that's another Asian face. That's another black face. I can't pull them apart. And so it's a matter of sort of discrimination with expertise. And their faces are just like songs. They're just like foods. They're just like wines. When you zoom in on something, you get better at it. But then when you're in a sort of separate domain you're not used to, you get worse at it. Does that sound like the baby thing?
Yeah, I think it is. And what it highlights is that the race of the person that is the viewer has basically no impact on their ability to see the people. It's very much kind of like training data. Right. It's training data, right? For
that's
an AI
exactly,
system.
That's exactly right. And in fact, for babies themselves, one of the sort of creepy findings, I don't know, is that white babies tend to prefer to look at white people. Black babies tend to prefer to look at black people. But it's not their own race. It's just you get a familiarity preference. You like to look at what you've seen before. And we know that there's an Israeli study that looks at kids' race in sort of a cosmopolitan environment. A lot of black people, white people around, they show no preference. And then again, it doesn't matter what color the baby is. It's just their training data.
When it comes to our biases that are trained heavily, seems slightly less inbuilt, humans are incredibly tribal. Do you think that we have a predisposition to a small amount of racism in all of us?
I think tribal is a great word here. Racism carries some extra baggage. So I want to be conscious.
I've never noticed that racism carries a little bit of extra baggage.
You've heard it before. Have you heard that it's a fraught issue? You're not of this country, are you? So it's not.
Tribal. Are humans predisposed to be tribal?
I've written about this, and people have summarized it as a Gawker headline: babies are a little racist. It's not quite true. And in fact, it's not quite true in an interesting way. We're very tribal. But here's a cool finding from the baby work and toddler work. Babies show strong preferences very early on, age one, age two, age three, into who to interact with, who to take a toy from, who to accept food from. And they've done these experiments where babies, I would say a white baby, is given something by a white person or black person, and they have to choose. And the cool finding is, up to a certain point, they don't care about color. They recognize color. They notice color. They have a preference sometimes to look. They just don't care about it. They care deeply about language. So, and it's not just, you see a baby raised in the States, they have a black person speaking English, offering them a toy, and a white person speaking French, offering them a toy. They'll choose it from the black person speaking
Fuck
English.
Fuck the French. That's what they're saying.
It's not specific to
the French. We're not racist against anybody except for the French.
You're taking this too literally. But yes. They hate the French. There we go. That's what I want people to take from my book. You know, I will say something actually pro-French, which is they did a study a while ago where they exposed babies born in France to either French or Russian. And babies preferred to listen to French. So they concluded this is a story I heard from the researchers. It may or may not be true. But they concluded, well, you like to listen to the language you were exposed to early on. The rhythms resonate through the womb and everything like that. And then some reviewers said, what if French just sounds better, period, for everybody? So they had to go do the study in Russia. And then they found Russian kids preferred Russian to French. So it's not that there's a universal preference for French. But the very idea somebody would say that is just a bit of pro-French to respond to your anti-French.
Rightly so. That's fine. We've balanced it out. The French people are still listening. I also was looking at a study from, who was the guy that wrote this psychopath book? British dude that lives in Australia.
John Ronson?
No. Oh. No. His name's escaping me. Anyway, him. What he was saying was how people have massive prejudice, much, much greater than between skin color for different accents. And this would be adaptive because typically, ancestrally, you would not have been exposed to people of different skin colors. I mean, what the fuck's where have you ended up that you've seen someone with a different skin color in, 2000 BC? But someone from the next valley who says a couple of vowels in a slightly different way, that's somebody that you should be very, very cautious of. And it makes so much sense. And I really, really love that insight, which was one I'd never thought of before, which is if somebody of a different race with the same accent as you walks into the room, you feel like you have so much in common with that person.
Yeah.
If somebody of the same race with a different accent walks into the room, it is obvious. It is straight, just so in your face and obvious. And you go, "Oh God, you're gonna be a little while before we got to find common ground for us to talk about."
And that's the argument. The argument is like the psychopath guy. Is he a psychopath or does he study psychopaths?
Studies psychopath. He may also be a psychopath, but he seemed quite nice. So
okay. The point is that from a sort of an adaptive point of view, from a historical point of view, evolutionary, you would expect language to be a wonderful cue to us versus them, and babies seem to think that way. Now, later on, you pick up whatever tribal, whatever counts as us versus them in your society. So if you're in Ireland at a certain point, it's one thing. If you're in Israel, it's another thing. If you're in the United States, it's another thing. So at some point, you start to realize that, wow, us versus them in my society may well be race, may well be skin color. And that might really matter a lot. And in fact, for adults, at least, there are three things we focus on when we look at a new person. The things that stick in memory, things that really count. Sex, gender, like male, female. Age matters. You'll remember whether you're talking to a baby or an adult or an old person or whatever. And race. But race is in some way the odd man out. Race is unlike the other two things. Race might take on significance as you're being raised in a society where race matters. If you go to a society where race matters less, maybe not because they're angels, but because they focus on linguistic differences or something else, then you won't be as attuned to it.
That's interesting. I just rounding out that conversation about memory, what does it suggest about our what we should do, how our attention system works, what people should do if they feel bad about their memory and remembering things, that stuff that isn't attended to is so easily forgotten?
Yeah. Nothing. You're kind of stuck to it. The funnel of attention is very limited. So, I mean, it would be maybe a bit of concrete advice. There's a couple bit of concrete advice, pieces of concrete advice. One is you could choose what to attend to. But if you want to remember what people wear when you talk to them, focus on what they wear. But you can't expect it to get into the system without making it through the sort of bottleneck of attention. So you need to attend. And people who are skilled at that sort of thing, like in some way radiologists who are looking for signs of cancer, or air traffic controllers, monitor trajectory. A lot of the training is what do you attend to? You know, if you put somebody who never played football, and they're all of a sudden they're playing a game of football, they don't know where to look. They don't know this counts and that counts. You know, they're looking at people's hairstyles. They're looking at, you know, watching the ice cream truck roll by. You know, there's certain part of becoming expert in is knowing what to attend to. Now, putting that aside, there are memory techniques. When I taught my intro psych course, I had a Joshua Four come in and give a guest lecture. He's a writer. He wrote a book called Moonwalking with Einstein, where he outlines the historical, the classical memory techniques, where you basically got to make vivid associations between things. And, you know, with a couple of hours of training, you could learn to do really powerful tricks of memory. But here's the thing, and he gave me permission to tell the story, which I tell in my book. He gives this bang up lecture in my class about memory techniques. Students love it. I get an email from him like a couple of hours later saying, dude, I left my phone in the class. Because he doesn't have good normal memory. That sort of stuff you can't train.
Wow. Yeah, I have a bunch of friends who were medical students, Anki, Ebbinghaus, forgetting curves, spaced repetition, yeah, all of that. Peter C. Brown, that wrote Make It Stick, was like episode 20 on the show, I think. And yet we do things like leave our keys,
yeah,
and
yeah,
meet someone, and as they are telling us their name, forget the name. Forget the first half of the name as they speak the second half of the name, because our mind is just somewhere else.
Yes. Yeah. And they're right. And that's actually a really good example, which is you want to remember people's names. You got to make a freaking effort, you know, Chris. And then I see your, and there's all these techniques which sound ridiculous. I see your face and I imagine a C around or something. I don't know, but which I'm horrible at that. But names, you could use techniques. Faces are tougher. And that's actually an enormous difference. Are you good with faces?
Not bad. As a club promoter for a long time, that was something that was pretty good for me. But what's worse is being good with faces and bad with names. Because what the fuck does it mean to be good with faces? Like, I've met this person before, which is even more awkward for you to say. Well, I suppose it mediates you going, hi, yeah, nice to meet you. And they say, oh, we've already met. But it's only half a step away from, hi, I know we've already met and I forgot your name.
I am so, so bad at both faces and names. I have said, good to see you, in the hopes that it's ambiguous between meeting them for the first time and meeting them and having met them.
Oh, you're hedging your bets.
I'm hedging my bets.
Very interesting.
Because if I say, well, okay, so true story. When I was at Yale, we had a party for incoming graduate students, try to lure them into coming into the program. We had a party at our house. And I go up to somebody and I say, you know, hi, it's really nice to meet you. Welcome to the, and they stare at me and says, I've been in the graduate program for 3 years here. And since you know, it's not, I don't know. There's this enormous variation. We have to forgive each other, and mostly me, for things out of our control.
Okay.
And being bad at faces is the thing.
I know very little about Freud. My completely self-taught psychology experience has almost exclusively missed out everything that he did. How much of him should anybody be taking seriously now in 2023?
So first, I bet you know more about Freud than you think you do, because Freud has sort of trickled into modern culture. So if you've ever heard somebody say to somebody else, you know, look, I'm not your mother, or he has an anal personality, or, you know, it's something like that. These are Freudian ideas. I don't think you need to know anything specific about Freud's theory, because for the most part, it's wrong. The details, the oral stage, the anal stage, the phallic stage, the Oedipal complex, the primal scene, the idea that for every kid, the most pivotal moment in their life is when they see their parents having sex or fantasize about it. It's a lot is just nonsense.
You think
just
a lot of this was just projection from him?
No, I think that's, he was actually, I think, he was not a nice man. He was vicious to his enemies and sometimes to his friends, and he was ruthless in his pursuits. He was pretty, seems psychologically normal in many ways. I do think he was a genius, really wonderful writer, brilliant scholar. What it was very much of a construction of his time, which was extraordinarily repressed about sex. And people really did come in with bizarre hysterical symptoms, for instance, that may well have been rooted to sexual repression. There were issues of, he struggled his whole career making sense of stories of sexual abuse that women told him. At one point, believing they were real, and then later on saying that they were fantasies by these women, and struggling with that. But wherever his views came from, they have not stood the test of time, with the exception of the most important thing of all. Which is Freud championed more than anybody else the idea that we have a dynamic unconscious, that what we think and what we do, who we fall in love with, who we vote for, who we hate, when we make mistakes, when we miss an appointment we were set up to do. He would view all of this as generated by factors that are not conscious to us, that we're not aware of. And this idea, he wasn't the first, but he was the one who developed the most. This idea, I think, is right. Like, sometimes I do political psychology or moral psychology, and people say, you know, we're really interested in why people voted for Trump or why other people voted for Biden. Well, you're not going to find out by just asking them. Because it's not that they lie to you, though they'll do that too. It's that they don't know. We don't know. You know, we tell narratives. I could say, so you have a very popular podcast. How did you get into it? What made you da-da-da? And you'll have a story. That's what we do. We have stories. Is your story true? Probably not. Probably the answer to a lot of stuff is stuff you're not aware of. And Freud was the first to sort of make such a thing about it. And there he was right. There's like 1,000, 1,000,000 psychology studies that support the idea we're driven by the unconscious. That's all you need to know about Freud.
That suggests something that I meant to say earlier on about the eyewitness. So the eyewitness erroneously points the finger at Paul and said, it's him that forgot my name and stole my lunch. And then the DNA evidence of her lunchbox shows that it wasn't you, it was me. And everybody then points at the eyewitness and says, willful deception. She was trying to pin it on Paul because she had a thing. And he goes, no. It is possible for you to fully believe what it is that you're saying, like the way that the memory system works allows you, the best way to deceive someone you're trying to deceive is to believe it yourself.
Yes, I mean that gets us into a really another interesting topic, which very much dovetails on Freud, which is why are some things unconscious in the first place? And the standard story is, well, consciousness is limited. You know, unless something needs to be conscious, better to keep it out of the system. So this is why we're not conscious of our blood pressure, we're not conscious of our body temperature, our heart rate. We can infer them from other things, but we don't have direct access to them. And maybe this is true for all sorts of things. You're not conscious of all these systems going on in your head. But the great evolutionary theorist, Robert Trivers, who's still around, suggested that there's another reason why something might be unconscious. And this is your reason, which is deception, which is sometimes the best way to fool somebody else is to fool yourself. So imagine, so take confrontations. You know, I'm in a physical confrontation with somebody and everything. And I all of a sudden want to act like, I will not back down. I will kill you, come any closer. I'm fearless. And I believe it myself, even though I'm not. But to convince the other person, which is what I'm really after, what the system works, is it's really good to believe it yourself. And the other example is falling in love, where sometimes the system, what's the best way to convince somebody you're head over heels in love with them? You'll never leave them. You're totally into them. Well, to believe it. And having ulterior motives, like a sort of one, well, if this doesn't work out, I have plan B. Having that not available to your consciousness is a wonderful way to deceive other people.
One of the interesting things about the love example is I actually don't know what the difference is between believing that you're in love with somebody and being in love with somebody. In the eyewitness example, we have a real world and then we have an experience and we can compare those two, right? The DNA on the lunchbox. In this scenario, I don't know what it would mean for your mind to, for my mind to kid me that I'm in love with you when I'm not.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would differ.
In a lot of ways, it would overlap. And it's hard to see the believing you're in love with somebody and being in love with somebody pulling apart too much. But you could imagine that you believe it, but at another level, you're constantly hedging. And that there's a caution to it. Imagine you're about to bond with somebody. You say, I'll never leave you, and you believe it totally. And then all of a sudden, you know, a part of your head clicks. Let's get a prenup. Where did that come from? And the fact that comes to mind maybe suggests that you really don't. That there's part of your head that's kind of looking towards other things. I mean, one of the findings which I kind of like, which is kind of sweet, is you ask people who are about to be married, what are the odds of you getting divorced? And they'll often say, 0, 1%, 2%, tiny. What are the odds of somebody else getting divorced? 50%, 60%, I know what the numbers are, but not me. And you see, that's kind of nice. It's kind of supporting what you're saying. That sort of over-optimism is part and parcel of what it is to be in love. You know, if you really thought it was 50%, that's not a good sign. Even though that's what that sort of cold-blooded math says. But I wonder if at some level you believe it, but you don't believe it. At some level, we hedge these things.
What do you think intuition is?
So there's many answers to that. Here's an answer which I like. It's from Danny Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize and talks about two systems of the mind. One, called System 2, is the rational, deliberative system. I think this is extremely important. I think it's what separates us from other creatures, where we plan, we do cost-benefit analyses. The other one is system on our gut. Our gut works metaphorically, our gut. Fast, intuitive, quick. Our system two could be egalitarian. Our system one's almost always racist. Our system two can do the math. Our system one goes with whatever options there. I think system one's the gut. And we have system one for a reason. It's really, sometimes we need to move quickly. Sometimes the statistics are the way to go. You don't want to work its way through. But despite what some people say, it's not always right. And sometimes you want to distrust your gut. I was once asked for a while if I would put up a billboard that could say anything. What would I say? And I after a while, I said, don't listen to your heart. And I think our heart, our gut feelings often are right within a narrow range, but let us down for a lot of things.
What's a better approach then?
Deliberation, rational deliberation, with the help of others, because we're really kind of sometimes awful deliberators. When I make a decision and I start thinking about it, I'm often thinking, well, let's explore all the ways in which I'm right. But if you have good friends, you talk about it and you say, well, I'm thinking of, you know, of leaving this person. I'm thinking of getting a new job. I'm thinking of moving here. And I'm really enthusiastic about it. And then your friends will say, well, let's work this out. And I think that that's sort of, if you have the time, if you have more than like 10 seconds to act, you have some time, deliberate. And it's like science. It's like politics at its best. It's like culture, where smart people with different views getting together can bring you way more than you can as an individual.
I wonder whether I'm seeing a trend at the moment of people being too deliberate with their decision making. I think maybe I'm wrong, but certainly a lot of my friends out here in Austin, I think, could actually do with a little bit more intuition, could actually do with letting go of some of the deliberate cerebral cognitive horsepower that they're applying to some of the decisions that they go through, and that they're moving more slowly, that they're vacillating, they're talking themselves into and out of decisions that are bad and good for them. And I wonder whether, I don't know, I mean, this is me totally bro-sciencing it here, but a lack of embodied practice, a lack of movement, time outside, where you're not just doing the thinking thing, more people have got knowledge worker jobs than ever before. And also, for the first time in history, your opinions are more important than your deeds. Now, you know, it's not really about what you do. It's about the takes that you have. And I wonder whether that is causing people to self-identify with their thoughts more than with their feelings and body.
Yeah. So I'm a pro-rational guy. And I've sort of like, so I'm inclined to like disagree with you on that. But I'll give you two reasons why I think you're right, or two cases where you're right. One is, for certain things, you don't want to deliberate. You want to go with your gut and everything. An obvious example is, if you're a really good tennis player, just return the backhand. Don't sit down and think about it, make a diagram or anything. It'll mess you up. And in fact, for really good athletes, thinking about it kills them. Thinking about it has led to people's careers being destroyed, where all of a sudden they said, you know, what is it like to catch a fly ball? You know, what do you know? How does it feel to throw a punch? Is this the right way? Is it this way? Is it this? And you're gone, because you have to let the body do it, let the gut system do it. And some things are probably like that. For people, if you're good, if you're socially adept, and someone says something at a party, you maybe some repartee or maybe an argument, go. Your gut is better, is statistically better than the rational system. That's one case. Another case is, I think our intelligence, when employed properly, could bring us to places that our gut never can. And I think it really is how to handle good choices. I don't think you should decide to get married in a split second. I don't think you should quit your job because you're just really in the mood to do that. But sometimes, and you actually said this, our rational system, all it is it defends your initial gut feeling. Jonathan Haidt has this line where, I disagree with him in general on this, but I think he's quite wise to point out a possibility, which is, sometimes our deliberating minds are like lawyers, not like judges. So it's not like a good judge balances things and makes a decision. A lawyer takes something and makes a case for it. And if that's what your rationality is being used for, do less of it.
At the other end of the spectrum to Freud would be Skinner and his behaviorism. He also seems to have become a little bit, or quite a lot less popular recently. Why has behaviorism been sort of thrown away? I thought that was pretty locked up.
It's deservedly so. So I have a lot of love for Freud. I have no love for Skinner. I met him once, though, when he was old. He gave a talk. He had an enormous influence on psychology. And his insight was he wasn't the first to develop, but building on this theory of basic learning mechanisms. Classical conditioning, sort of Pavlov thing. You know, you hear a dentist whittling, and you flinch. You know, you see a commercial for some delicious food, your mouth waters. But also operant conditioning, rewards and punishment. It's how we train animals. It's very useful. But Skinner was in some way, I'll put this in the most offensive way possible, led a strange cult where you could only look at what people did and their inputs, and you can't talk about their internal states. Some behaviorists would say this is not scientific to talk about memories or beliefs or desires, dreams, ambitions. Others would say these things don't exist at all. We're just behaviors, nothing else.
Input
and response. Input and output.
Yep.
There's a joke about two behaviorists at a conference, they have sex, and one of them says to the other one, was it good for me? And the idea is, you know, to explain the joke, there's no such thing as monitoring your own states. All you got is your behavior. And that's so weird. Of course, whatever my complaints are with the AI movement, they get something really important right, which is that you can't explain and program complex behavior without putting a lot of machinery inside. Statistical analyses, I think also rules, memory bases, and so on. And, you know, Skinner thought that this was all unscientific. I think the fact the existence of computers has shown that building machines with stuff inside and trying to explain the stuff inside is how you do good science of intelligent behavior. And it's how psychologists do their stuff.
Are we losing something by casting off the insights of behaviorism in the modern world?
It's a good question. I think sometimes Skinner gets it right. The time I think about Skinner the most, so Skinner was one of his nice ideas was that of intermittent reinforcement. And the idea is, if I want to make you learn to do something quickly, I'll reinforce you every time. The you could be a you. It could also be a rat or a pigeon. I'll reinforce you every time. But suppose I want you to do something forever. I want you to stick with it. Then I randomly reinforce you rarely. And then you start getting in the behavior. And because you don't expect a reward every time, it's always coming up next, you can't stop yourself. I've never been tempted by slot machines, which was Skinner's favorite example. But like a lot of people, social media gets me. And you know, so 3 a.m, I wake up, I decide, isn't it a great idea to check my phone and check Twitter? It's perfect, brilliant idea. So, and then I spend an hour flicking my finger up. Oh, that's nice. Huh. And then this intermittent reinforcement. And I'm like a rat in Skinner's cage. And so much of the sort of addictive techniques that people in Facebook and Twitter use are straight up Skinner. So, you know, I'm not a fan, but we ignore them at our own peril.
Yeah, interesting. You know Diana Fleischman, evolutionary psychology lady?
I don't know her personally, but I like her work.
Yeah, she's got a book coming out called How to Train Your Boyfriend. And she's, I think she's terming it evolutionary behaviorism, that she's trying to use EP to inform that back and forth that you do have. And I you know, Peterson's touched on this a little bit where he says, you know, if your partner does something that you want them to keep on doing, make sure that you remember to praise them about it. That's not exactly rats in a cage. That just feels a little bit more like not being a shit human, but
yeah. And people, so there's an insight there, but people are complicated in a way. So suppose you want your kid to read. Let's take it away from that more interesting domain of sex and let's get boring here. You want your kid to read. So what's going to, well, give him, every time he reads a book, give him $20. Certain age, give us a lot of money because, oh my gosh, this is great. And he'll read books. But the argument against this is his ultimate view will be books don't have any intrinsic value. Like a rat's never going to think this. A rat's going to bang away at whatever you put in front of it. Shoot down a maze for the reward. It will never think going down this maze is kind of futile. It's just for the reward. It has no intrinsic value. But people will do that. People will do that. And, you know, imagine for either of us getting some sort of monetary award for doing something. You might do it if the money's big enough, but the minute the money goes away, you'll stop. Sometimes for people, it's almost the opposite, where the way to get people to value something, very anti-Freud, sorry, anti-Skinner, is to get them to pay for it. So therapists say, with some justification, if the clients don't pay, they don't take this seriously.
Commitment device.
Exactly. Politicians like volunteers. Now, they like volunteers because they're cheaper, but they also like volunteers because after you volunteer for a politician, you think, oh my God, I really believe in this. while if they're doing it for $50,000 a month, they think they're doing it for the money. Who cares with the politician? So this is a way in which operant conditioning, the logic of it, I'm not sure you want to reinforce your boyfriend for something. If you want him to do that thing, when the reinforcement goes away.
Interesting. That'll be very, very fascinating. I totally understand what you mean. There's always these stories about parents trying to use reverse psychology on kids to get them to want to eat vegetables. Yeah. Like, oh, unless you're good, you won't get any vegetables. That's right. And then have you ever looked at any of this stuff? Is that legit? Does it work?
Nothing works, but this is one of the lessons of life, that nothing works. But the logic is right. Look, my next project after this book is I'm very interested in perverse desires. I'm very interested in why people do something because it's bad. I have a TED talk coming out on this next week, and the draw is the badness.
What's an example of a bad?
The classic example, which is St. Augustine in the Confessions. One day he and his friends go into an orchard and they just start stealing the pears. They're not hungry. They throw them away. They throw them to pigs, actually. And when Augustine's like shocked at this, this isn't a story. He says, I'm going to tell you stories of sexual debauchery. But then he says, I understand my sexual debauchery is reinforcing, as you know, Skinner would say. Why did I do this? He said, because it was wrong, because I shouldn't have done it. So then I started a thing called a perversity project, where I started this webpage, and I got people to tell me, send me stories of things that they did that were perverse in that way. And my favorite story is this guy, a young guy, says, I'm there with my friend, and we each order an ice cream. We're walking down the street, and suddenly I get this urge, and I jam my finger into his ice cream. And my friend says, dude, why'd you do that? And the guy's right. He said, I didn't know. But I said, I just thought for a second, it'd really be fucked up if I stuck my finger in his ice cream. And this is a very non-Skinnerian thing. But the desire to do something just because it's really fucked up, not despite it, but just because, is a powerful lure.
When it comes to development, we talked about babies and stuff earlier on. Have we got any idea how much babies actually know?
Yeah. That's one of the great discoveries of psychology. I've been lucky enough to be acquainted with work with some people who made these great discoveries, like Elizabeth Spelke at Harvard, for instance. Babies know surprisingly a lot about the world. By the time they hit about their first birthday, you could test in subtle ways and you find they understand the physical world. They could reason about gravity. They understand when an object goes out of sight, it still remains. They reason about how things move by contact. They also understand the social world. They know that if one person helps another person, the person who's helped will later go back to that person who helped them. They know that if one person messes with another person, the person who got messed with will avoid that first person or sometimes attack them. And you do these incredible research programs showing that very early on, we seem to be hardwired with some rich understanding of the world. So people like Plato and Kant and Chomsky, I think, have been vindicated by the science of developmental psychology. And the idea that the mind is a blank slate has been proven to be wrong.
What do you mean pre-programmed?
It means that just like every other animal starts with certain instincts about the world, some basic understanding of the world to varying degrees. Maybe they already know how to communicate. Maybe they already know how to move around. We're no exception. So we come in the world in some ways tremendously behaviorally helpless. Babies are extraordinarily vulnerable for a long period of time. And then there's again an argument that this is because you need a long period of time for development because we're such social, cultural creatures. There's an enormous period of helplessness and then an enormous period of waiting before sexual maturity just to get the system all up to speed, just to do the learning that has to be done. But in addition to the capacity to learn, I think evolution has wired us up with a pre-programmed understanding of the world. Some things don't have to be learned.
Wow. I was thinking about this before. I was walking around the park that's next to where I live, and I saw a dog, and it does its business, and then it does that back leg flicking thing, which, I mean, it does, it wasn't even facing in the right direction. It was pointless.
Yeah.
But I always wonder, who taught the dog to do that? Yeah. Did the dog learn, did it watch other dogs? Is it a reflex, like putting your hand on a hot stove?
For a lot of the behaviors of animals, including really complicated behaviors, more complicated than that, they're just born with it. Now, animals differ. Some animals pop out and are basically adults. They're basically, they know everything. Other animals, there's a long period of learning. And for other animals, it's kind of a compromise. So birdsong, for instance, is partially innate. But then depending on the community of birds you're raised in, it will all do a bit of learning, like learning English versus French versus Korean or whatever. I think for humans, there probably are not that many inborn behaviors. A few. You take a baby, you take its hand, you put your hand, the baby will grip, stuff like that. We were once, you know, hairy animals that, and there's a bit of a connection with that. So we have a few behaviors like that. But I think most of the stuff is just pre-wired understanding of the world.
You know, my favorite thing, effect that we have that's vestigially carried over from our time as primates. I learned this from Robin Dunbar. And it's the stroke response that you get. Yeah. And there is a maximum and a minimum speed that your finger needs to move across someone. It's around about 3 centimeters per second is the optimal speed. And any quicker than about 3 centimeters per second, you don't get the same area of the brain lighting up, because quicker than 3 centimeters per second wouldn't be fast enough for you to be able to pick little bits of whatever it is out of fur. And they look, and they've done the same thing whilst doing their primatology work, and it's exactly the same. I really love that.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, that's in his new one, Friends. I did this book, Friends. Really great. So you mentioned there about language, something that you touch on in your new one. What's the relationship between language and thought? I had this lesson that I learned a little while ago. I think it's Ludwig Wittgenstein, and he says, the limits of my language mean the limits of my world. And I'd taken that to mean that a richer vocabulary means a richer life, that basically the more precisely that I can describe the things that have occurred using the best kind of language, the richer I get to experience it. How much bro science horse shit have I used there?
No. There's some claims of relationship between language and thought, which I think are deep and important and true. Like, you know, we could use language to convey our thoughts, which is what we're doing now. We could, to some extent, the language we have reflects our thoughts. One simple example is by John McWhorter, where he points out that that so many of our obscenities have to do with God and damnation and sex, and universally, because these are universally taboo and serious things. A deeper connection is that language like English uses the same expressions for space and time. You know, I put the coin in my pocket. I'll do it in an hour. So, you know, we've got a spatial thing. Language is all over work on that model, suggesting that there's a deep relationship between space and time in our how we think. And this gets conveyed by language. What isn't true, or what doesn't seem to be true, is the claim that the specific language you learn affects how you think. It's a very popular idea that, you know, people who learn a language like Navajo, which might have a different time system, will think differently about time. People learn English versus French versus Korean versus Urdu versus whatever will think differently about the world because of the structure of their language. And it turns out that whenever people look at it, it doesn't seem to be true. It seems to be that languages all around the world have the same sort of communicative power and don't seem to reflect what we think, but don't seem so much to shape what we think.
Given that a lot of the time people think in words and the words that they think in are in the language that they're in, what does the fact that the language that you speak doesn't seem to impact the things that you think mean? How do we square this circle?
I think what's really interesting is, and this brings us back to what we were talking about before, we have a feeling we think in words, but we really can't in a way. So suppose you think, you know, I'm going to go play baseball because for instance, I got to go and buy a bat. Well, the English word bat is ambiguous between, you know, the baseball bat and the flying animal, but your thought isn't ambiguous. You know, linguists like the ambiguous sentence, visiting relatives can be boring. which is ambiguous. It could mean when they visit you, it's boring, or when you visit them, it's boring. But it's not there's no ambiguity when you think. So the idea we think in English is, I think, to some extent, the fact that you do your thinking and you kind of have a shadow impression of English words that go with it. But you don't really think in English in the same sense.
That's interesting.
You look unconvinced.
I'm trying to work out. I don't speak another language. I don't know whether you do, but I only speak English. And I've heard about people who speak other languages sometimes dream in different languages. Yeah. And that there's, I saved a Psychology Today article that I the other week about this, something to do with the people who dream in different languages. It has some kind of downstream psychological effect on them. I just can't work out how I'm so language heavy when it comes to my thought.
Yeah.
I can't get myself outside of what to me feel like the thermodynamics of thinking, you know?
Yeah. So there is a tight band between language and thought, but here's how it would go. If you were also fluent in Japanese, maybe you'd get to think in Japanese, but your thoughts wouldn't change. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. Sometimes languages have a flavor to them in a sense that if you were raised in Italy, learned English as a second language, sometimes thinking and talking in Italian will bring back certain memories and feelings of the past, while English will get you in sort of another mode. You know, we do pick up associations, but the mental life of somebody who thinks in Japanese is not different from the mental life of somebody who speaks in English.
Good. Yes,
if it was, the world would be a lot different than what it is.
Each language would essentially be a different sort of species in a psychological sense. Right, yes, exactly. That makes sense. Yes, I understand. You've got it. Nailed it. Right. What are the biggest differences between male and female psychology?
Look, it has a lightning round feel to it. The biggest difference between men and women is that on average, men are sexually and romantically attracted to women, and on average, women are sexually attracted and romantically attracted to men. That's the biggest difference. You know, obviously, it's not 100%. A lot of men are attracted to men. A lot of men are attracted to both. A lot of men are attracted to neither. But the majority of men are attracted to women. That's the biggest difference. When you get out of that, the big differences have to do very roughly that men, and this is of all the sort of research I talk about in my book, surprising me, oh my God, evolutionary stuff, you know, that's very weak. This is the sort of research that gets done in 100 countries. This is the sort of research we were talking before about the psychologist David Buss. And there's these enormous meta studies and across different, and you find big cultural differences, but you always find the same sex differences. And the sex differences typically are roughly men are more aggressive and risk-taking, and women are kinder and more nurturing. So, and you don't have to go to a psychology lab to see this. You go anywhere in the world and you say, who does more of your killing? It's men. Women may be aggressive in other ways. They may be, I don't want to make try by who's verbally aggressive or socially aggressive or whatever, but pure violence is mostly a male activity. The care and nurturance of children is mostly a female activity. And this is true for humans, and it's true for primates who are sort of similar to humans. Now, you always got to have the caveat that you're ending up talking about bell curves. So everywhere in the world is also true, men are taller than women. This does not preclude the fact that there are some women taller than the average man and some men shorter than the average woman. You kind of have, whenever talking about human differences, maybe it's worth putting in this caveat. There was a study I recently read. What I loved about it says all the continents and just tons and tons of people, an enormous amount of people. And it just asked people a simple question. How many sex partners do you want to have before you die? And in every country you look at, men want more than women. But the cool thing was, in addition to that, is you got cultural differences. So in some countries, like in some parts of the world, like Eastern Europe, everything's higher. So men want a lot and women want a lot. In other cases, in, let's say, Africa, everything's lower. And the way it works is that women in Eastern Europe want more sex partners than men in Africa. So what you have is you have a sort of what psychology called one effect, a main effect of gender. Wherever you go, men want more than women. But you also have an effect of culture. In this place, it's more than this place. And then you have cases where there's this crossover, where the effect of culture is so big, you have the cases where it kind of flips if you compare it. But to answer your question, issues like aggression, risk-taking, and then other aspects of sexual preference. Typically, men want younger partners. Women care less about age, stuff like that.
Yes. The best example I saw about the disposition, let's say, that males would do war and women would do care, was from Joyce Benenson. And she spent a ton of time with kindergarten kids. And she says, if you look at the games that 3 and 4 year olds play, the boys will find an enemy, even if it's an imaginary one. It's aliens, it's cowboys, it's robbers, it's whatever. And the girls will be keeping something alive. That's the way that's what they tend to lean toward. And, you know, for all denial of sex differences thing wants to happen, this is replicated in chimps. You know, you give a fluffy little sort of baby chimp toy to a even slightly smaller baby chimp. And the same thing happens there too.
Yeah. And I think the stuff that the basic difference is grounded in our evolutionary history. People have looked at cultures where more egalitarian cultures, you look like Norway or Sweden, those countries, versus less egalitarian cultures like countries in the Middle East, for instance. The effect is shows up everywhere. In fact, some of these sex differences are bigger in more egalitarian cultures. Which seems so weird. You'd think that they would just disappear in them. But the reason why they're bigger is that if you're in an egalitarian society, you're free to sort of express whatever you want to do. And again, the sort of overlapping bell curves is worth keeping in mind, as well as the fact that just because something is sort of a natural tendency doesn't mean it's morally good, you know. If some women want to be aggressive, if some men want to be nurturant, I think people should be free to do whatever they want. But this is the way the trend goes.
Do you think that attachment theory is bullshit? Because I have been seeing this more and more. I have a bunch of friends that work as coaches and therapists that rely very heavily on attachment theory and whatnot. And I don't know how far it's getting out over its skis. Have you looked at attachment theory?
It's so funny you should say this. I got into a discussion a few days ago with somebody, a developmental scholar, and I said, attachment theory is bullshit. And we argued back and forth. And bullshit's too strong in that there are different attachment styles parents and children have. There's different attachment styles we could have as adults. I think the strong claims about them are bullshit. I think in this domain, as in so many others, people tend to forget the basics or principles of how traits get passed on from parents to children. So the fact that a child in a certain attachment style as a kid might duplicate that attachment style as an adult need not be because of experience. It could be just from the get-go. It was maybe an aggressive parent or a timid parent, and it just got passed on to the kid.
When you're saying that, you're not talking about a behaviorally aggressive or timid parent. You're talking about a genetically predisposed aggressive or timid parent. You're talking about heritability and behavioral genetics here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I don't have any deep problem with talking about attachment styles to say that that's one style and that's another style. I think some of the claims about them really do go over the skis. I think in general, one of the lessons of a lot of research, one of the more, again, I keep talking about sort of findings from psychology, I think are a little bit shocking. You would expect that the parent's relationship to the kid would have an enormous effect on what we grow up to be. It's just common sense. A loving parent makes a kid later on loving, says that a brutal parent, you know, traumatizes the kid. It is not true as much as we think it is. A lot of the traits are just passed on by the genes and environment doesn't matter very much. And to the extent environment matters, which is sometimes, you know, 50%, 60%, 40%, whatever, it doesn't seem to have so much to do with parenting, but more experiences outside the home. So, and what this means is that you take parents and they have biological kids and then they adopt kids into their family. And if parenting played a huge role, you'd expect the adopted kids to be very much like the biological kids. They're raised the same way. It doesn't seem to happen as much as it is. And to the extent that attachment styles get folded into those sort of parenting arguments, parenting matters immensely for shaping your personality and intelligence, I think there are problems with it.
So would it be your view that attachment style is less malleable? You know, for instance, personality, your Ocean Big Five personality, yeah, doesn't seem to change a massive amount throughout your life. You can... There are a few interventions to massively change that set point, yeah, at least compared with other things. Would you see attachment style kind of folded in with that kind of predisposition?
I'd be tempted to think that, but I don't know. I would want to be careful and want to look at the studies. You're right that for the most part, again, putting aside attachment, our personality is relatively constant over our lifetime. A kid who at age 8 is introverted and agreeable and studious, you know, grow to be an adult, most likely who's introverted, agreeable, and studious. We can, to some extent, hack our personalities. Sometimes people do it with medication if you're over anxious. There are sometimes people claim that disciplines, everything from, you know, mindfulness meditation to stoicism to Catholicism, can transform your personality in certain interesting ways. But for the most part, doesn't change that much. You know, I sometimes think that this is me not being a psychologist, this is just me thinking that the trick to life isn't so much changing yourself, but is finding friends, lovers, family, unemployment, fun that mesh with how you are. I'm not an extroverted guy, and I could have tried to be extroverted, but then took it to be a salesman. But maybe I had ideas. I'm not a salesman. I'm a professor, and I could be a bit less introverted, and less extroverted, and more focused on other things.
I really like that. I really like that takeaway, especially as someone who recently moved from a country where I was felt a little discordant, a little bit, yeah, like an off note, and then to one now where it feels a bit more aligned, and I have people around that I can understand a little bit more. And I went from a career and a job that I was incredibly successful in and took a ton of pride in what we did, running these massive events and one of the, yeah, biggest events companies in the UK and all the rest of it. But again, with that, there was just something a little bit, it was, you know, half an octave off. And I thought, what's going on here? And, you know, I'm now doing something which, again, aligns with my disposition, with the way that I like to live my life, with the things that I like to think about in private, in public.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. If you take it as relative truth that the person that you are is going to remain pretty constant in terms of your disposition throughout your life, that's not to say that you can't change the kind of capacities that you have and learn things, but your propensity toward wanting to learn or wanting to, yeah, be open or wanting to change or wanting to be neurotic or wanting to be extroverted are going to stay the same. You go, okay, look, these are kind of the physics of my universe. They're not absolute laws, but if I try and fight against them, they're going to drag me back toward whatever they are. How can I marry what I am with what I want to become with what the world can deliver to me? I think that's a really nice way to fold all of that together.
Yeah, I mean, I like your example, which is if you're in the UK and you're kind of a natural American, well, you could try to stomp that aspect of yourself out of you, or you could do what you did and move to Texas, you know, and I think there's an advantage. It might be easier to move to Texas. One thing to keep in mind as implicit in all of this is I think there are general ways to be that are bad, that are just maladaptive, you know, that slide into mental illness. You know, nobody wants to be schizophrenic. Nobody wants to be severely depressed. Nobody wants to be incredibly anxious. And for that, you'd want to fix it. You're not going to find a world that's good, that where you prosper in it. But within a surprising large range, there's just a lot of ways to be. I was talking about this in my intro psych class, and the student raised her hand and asked me, it was a very good question, saying, well, what's the best personality for all these things? What's the best? And it's a good question because a lot of people think there's an answer to this. Extroverted, agreeable, low neuroticism. They're wrong, actually. That in some worlds, being an extrovert is a real power. In other lives, being an extrovert is a recipe for misery and failure, and introverts thrive. In some worlds, it's really good to be agreeable. Everybody likes an agreeable person. But disagreeable person, people, you know, transform everything, and so on and so forth. Where so it's not as if you get yourself on a personality scan, you find yourself, oh, I want to move here, because that's the right way to be. Rather, there's a world and jobs and people for just about every space in the personality matrix.
Does that explain why people differ so much in their intelligence and their personality, that there are, or there would have been, a lot of different environments and ways to succeed? And if we had pigeonholed every human to be this much agreeable and this much neurotic and this much whatever, you wouldn't have had as effective of a tribe?
That's really interesting. I don't know. I've heard that sort of it. There's two ways of looking at it. One is, any system's going to have noise. Why isn't everybody exactly the same height? Because there's just random stuff with diet and genes, and it pushes us around and everything. But it might well be that in some ways, some degree of human variety turns out to be adaptive. And in some way, you don't have to talk sort of for the good of the tribe or good of the group. In some way, it's sort of frequency dependent, where if enough people in my society are A's, it might pay to be a B. And then once you get enough B's and they overwhelm you, it might pay to be an A. If enough of people are agreeable, a disagreeable person could clean up. If enough people are disagreeable, an agreeable person, oh my God, everybody wants to be with them. And so in this way, in a sort of dynamic, one could imagine that a bit of variety turns out to be beneficial.
It's like a personality arms race, in a way.
Yes, that's
yeah,
right.
Where everyone's right. Finding different right. ways to come through.
I mean, consider some other sort of market. Like, consider, you know, TV shows. Why doesn't everybody make the same great TV show? Because if you have 10 prestige dramas, all of a sudden, a dirty lowbrow comedy is everybody. Oh my God, let's see that! What a break from it. And then when you get enough of those, you toss in some reality shows, you get enough, and then you get a range of things, because in this world, sometimes there's sort of negative, adverse selection to being the way everyone else is.
We've just touched on behavioral genetics there. I had Robert Plowman on the show maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and the guy's phenomenal. I love his work. I feel like, if I was to look at the field of science at the moment, not diet, but sort of psychology and personal development style stuff, the biggest hole in terms of public education, the longest lever that we could push down on, would be teaching people about how behavioral genetics works, about how heritability works. I think that would help people to make better life choices, better partner choices. It would help parents to feel less culpable or less neurotic and over concerned about the outcomes that their kids are going to have. And then when you fold in the, you know, the nurture part of the nature nurture debate, isn't the nurture that you give them, it's the nurture that Jim's dad next door gives them, and it's the nurture of the boxing coach that they give them, and the friends that are around them that they impart on them. I feel like that, it, from the outside looking in, is the biggest hole that we have in terms of sort of public education.
I think that's a wise point. I'll just add two things. One is, as you notice, that gets very politicized. And, you know, talk about genes and behaviors and everything, for some people, it brings up a specter of scientific racism and, you know, Holocaust and all of that stuff. So I think now we're starting to sort of say, well, we could sensibly talk about these things without it being carried with the ugly baggage of history. Just like, you know, behaviorism, other ideas of human nature similarly have an ugly baggage of of control of totalitarian governments and everything. I think we've got to look at the facts in some in a way that's compassionate and reason. The other thing is, at some level, this is stuff worth getting out. But at another level, when people aren't on Twitter or Facebook or writing op-eds and everything, people kind of know. There's some really nice stuff done by Emily Willoughby, where she just asks people, from a scale of 0 to 100, how heritable are these different traits? You know, how your introversion, aggression, religiousness, sexual orientation, eye color, and so on. Explains a little bit what this means. And then graphs it. It turns out your average person is not bad at knowing this. Your average person pretty much matches, with some exceptions, the scientific literature. When you're not dealing with people who are ideologues and you ask people, say, do you think how shy somebody is sort of a genetic trait? People often appreciate that. Yeah, it is to some extent.
There was a chart in Plowman's book, Blueprint, and I think that that's the same study that you're talking about. Yeah. Well, I had a guy on talking about embryo selection and genetic enhancement, Johnny Anomaly, talking about this recently. And that, I think, will force everybody. It will be a very difficult to avoid red pill for everybody about heritability, because as soon as you can go in and say, well, look, these are the raw materials that we're playing with, and this is how far we can push these different things. And downstream from that, look at the changes that children have from genetic interventions before they were born.
Yeah.
It kind of bursts this conversation open a little bit. And that technology is not slowing down. It's not stopping. It seems like it's partly already here, and in the future is only going to be more here.
I think that's right, but I'll give you something which is here. And I haven't looked into this, but here's my intuition. Many, many people have kids through donor sperm and donor eggs. I don't think there's many people who say, I don't care. It's all however you send me, give me anybody's sperm, anybody's eggs, I'm in. No, people really want the sperm and eggs of people they see as having, you know, not just good physical health, but they haven't had a history of severe mental illness. They want people who are Nobel Prize winners. They want women who have been to the Ivy Leagues. They want people who are, and I think, when push comes to shove, people have an understanding that that this stuff matters.
You know what's very interesting there? I don't know whether you've considered this, but Johnny taught me about this when it comes to sperm donor selection criteria for women. What you get to do as a woman is bypass your own mating psychology with regards to what you're attracted to in terms of what seduces you, which may cause you to downstream use those genetics to form a child. And what you actually do is you optimize for the traits that you want your child to have independent of the attraction. So a lot of the time, like a pleasant disposition or kindness is something that is really, really optimized for, being like dominance and stuff, which may be something which is sexually attractive, but in a child, do I want like a super dominant child? Well, perhaps not. Yeah. And that was the first time that I've ever thought, oh my God, look at what happens when you can separate out having sex from the production of the child that comes from it, or attraction from procreation.
It's really interesting. You know, there's this work, I bet you're familiar with this, on what's attractive. So you take an average face. Average faces are pretty attractive because you factor out all the flaws and everything, and homogeneity, you know, maybe genetic heterogeneity, whatever, but they're pretty aggressive. For female faces, if you dial up the femininity of the face, everybody thinks they're prettier. Make the eyes bigger, makes lips fuller and prettier. But for male faces, if you dial up the masculinity, it doesn't quite do it. You see these fishes, these testosterone guys, you know, this enormous jaw and like that. And you know, and in some cases, they're considered worse. And there you're capturing what you just said, which is for women, there's sort of two things that pull apart. Which is, you may not want a hyper aggressive, most manly man. There's a draw to that, but you also want a man with actually some female traits, some prototypically female traits, who isn't as aggressive, who is more compassionate, more kind. And so the case for women selecting men isn't as simple. And you're exactly right. In a case where you could separate what you want as a kid for your kid and what you want for your partner, there is a separation women will adopt.
Do you think that psychology can help us understand what a good life is?
I think the question of what the good life is not ultimately a psychological question. It is a moral and philosophical question. You know, if one psychologist said a good life is simple pleasure, hedonism, maximize, you know, the amount of hedons, the amount of orgasms and cookies and all that stuff. That's the good life. And another one said, no, a good life is being moral and relationships and suffering. Not kind of an experiment to figure out which is right. There's a philosophical disagreement here. I think the second guy is right, actually, but it's not a psychological question. Where psychology comes in is once you decide what a good life is, what to maximize, a psychologist can tell you a little bit about how to get there. Then it becomes an empirical question. You know, if so I've been interested in the question, for instance, of do children make you happy? And the question of whether it's good to have children in some sort of abstract way is not a psychological one, but what's the effect of people's lives on having children? And the answer actually turns out is complicated. It depends. It's different for men than for women. It's in countries with good child care.
Dig into that. Explain.
So the original findings studies were done by Kahneman in the United States. And they found that they used an experience sampling thing where they took where it turned out that people who had kids were on the whole less happy than people without kids. And when they were with their kids, it was kind of stressful. It wasn't a good time. And so the argument was having kids doesn't make you happy. But then there were more studies then. And the answer, as always with these things, is it depends. In countries which have good childcare, parents tend to be happier than non-parents. The United States is in some way atypical as a very wealthy country, but doesn't have very good paid childcare. Younger parents are in some way less happy than older parents. Single parents, as you can imagine, find the period where their kids are young to be very difficult. Women sometimes find it a bit harder than men. To me, the most interesting findings comes when you separate the questions of how much pleasure you're getting from your kid, how happy does your kid make day to day, and how worthwhile do you think it is? How meaningful do you think it is? Because then when you ask about meaning and worthwhileness of value, significance, you do find that there's a real significance to having kids. And for me, you know, I have two sons in their 20s. And actually, you know, I actually really like raising them. So maybe it's not a complicated thing. But in some way, if people say, so what do you think of having kids? I wouldn't say, yeah, it really added a lot of pleasure to my life. Seems like the wrong way of doing it. It's just, it is of great significance. I love them. They're the most important thing I ever did, separate from any happiness they gave me.
I remember learning about Kahneman and Dan Gilbert, and they had two different conceptions of happiness. It may have even been from you that I actually learned.
It was from the sweet spot. I had the debate, yes.
Yes, right. And one was hedonism and the other is meaning. And yep. One is you spend the remainder of your life on a lilo with a cocktail in a pool, yeah, sunning yourself. And the other one, you do difficult things, but in retrospect, yep, you're glad that you did them. It's my belief, upon reflecting on your book from 2 years ago, that I forgot it was from your book, that your personal disposition is one of the most important determinants as to how you move up and down on that spectrum. So if you are the kind of person that ruminates, that's introspective, that will tend to reflect and consider your decisions perhaps a little bit more, that will seek the meaning in things, I don't know where on ocean hedonism lies, maybe like openness to new experience or something. I don't know. But anyway, my point being, if you are the non-hedonistic person, you need to optimize for things that are going to give you meaning. Whereas if you're someone that can take more simple pleasure in the moment-to-moment experience of life, then perhaps you also need to factor that in too. Yeah. How far off do you think I am?
I don't think you're far off at all. I think that I'm a pluralist. And I think there's a lot of things you might want to maximize in your life, you know, meaning, pleasure. We haven't talked about being a good person, being moral. We haven't talked about spirituality for some people. And everybody got to choose how you rank them, how you prioritize them. And I think you're exactly right that some people be more comfortable with one choice over another. Some people like to be challenged. Some people don't. I think for everybody, though, the simple, pure hedonism plan is probably not a good idea, even on its own terms. Like, suppose we both say, my gosh, all that matters is happiness. But we could agree on that, but still say, but don't try to be happy. So for one thing, you get bored if you're just happy all the time. Happiness, you get the so-called hedonic treadmill. You're just going to get bored of stuff. But for another, there's actually some nice studies finding that at least for people in the West, the East is a little bit different. You ask them, how important is it for you to be happy? And then you ask them how happy they are. And there's a negative correlation. People put value and importance on happiness tend to be less happy. Now, immediately, somebody like you says, yeah, it's complicated, because you can imagine the criticism being, if you're less happy, maybe you take happiness more seriously. So it's hard to pull them apart. But I think in general, trying to be happy, and this is ancient wisdom, is kind of a sucker's move. And what you should try to do is maximize other things. And then happiness will come along if you're lucky, or do it right for the ride.
Looking forward, given that we are now, perhaps there's more areas of research to be decapitated by the replication crisis, but looking forward, what do you think are some areas of psychology that are the unknowns, or the unknown unknowns? Where are we? Where should psychologists be looking, or what can people expect, do you think, from psychology over the next couple of decades?
Wow, that's such a good question. I think in ways that I find it hard to anticipate, I think that the rise of AI over the last year or so, 6 months, what's happening now, ChatGPT, is going to transform psychology in certain ways. I know people, and I'm actually involved in one project where we're testing people to get their intuitions. We're also testing ChatGPT. We want to know what it thinks too, with an eye towards pulling apart what a statistical learning machine would do and what a person would do. So I feel that that's a very rich area. I'll tell you something, another area, just to kind of mix it up a bit. There's one part of psychology which is sort of punched below its weight, and it's clinical. Clinical, say, I've heard experts in the field, expert clinicians say, over the last 30 years, there's been no big developments in clinical psychology. We know treatment works, but it's not like the treatment works better now than it did in 1990. Medications work, drugs work, but, you know, we got Prozac, we got, you know, lorazepam, we got these things. They're not very different from what was on the market 20 years ago. I wonder if that's going to change. There's a lot of interest in psychedelics, a lot of interest in like mindfulness meditation. There's a lot of new idea, a lot of interest in neuroscientific interventions involving sort of basically zapping the brain in different ways. And it wouldn't surprise me if we're on the cusp of a revolution understanding mental illness.
That would be pretty cool.
That would be really cool.
Ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate your work. I absolutely love it. The new one, Psych, is great. Where should people go if they want to check out the stuff that you do and keep up to date with your work?
I got a website, paulbloom.net, and I got a Twitter thing, paulbloom@Yale. And in both of them, I mercilessly try to impose this, until at one point in Twitter, they're going to say, stop doing this. We're not going to follow you anymore. So I got to stop.
You're no longer a Twitter account. You're just a salesman.
I'm just a salesman and everything. So, but that's where to find me. Right, thank you so much. This is always a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for tuning in. Paul Bloom, what an absolute legend. That guy is legitimately one of the main fixtures in the world of psychology, and has been writing on this stuff for so long. It's really, really great that he's put together all of his favorite insights into this most recent book. And I find him a incredibly engaging and compelling speaker. So I really, really hope that you enjoyed that one. Also, don't forget that you can receive the Whoop 4.0 for free and get your first month for free by going to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. You can get a 37% discount site-wide and worldwide from MyProtein at bit.ly/proteinwisdom and the code modernwisdom at checkout. And you can get 5 free travel packs, a year's supply of vitamin D, and more from Athletic Greens at athleticgreens.com/modernwisdom. I'll see you next time.